Coming up today, vaccine passports in France and the unique loneliness of quitting your job during COVID. You're listening to the Wired UK podcast, your essential weekly guide to all the big stories in tech, science, business and culture. I'm your host for the week, Vicky Turk, and joining me are Natasha Bernal.
Hello.
And Matt Burgess.
Hello.
This was the week when Apple revealed the iPhone 13 and Apple Watch Series 7 at its big event. There were no massive surprises, with the new devices showing refinement rather than total reimagination.
It was also the week when Instagram's secret research into its effects on young people was revealed. According to documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal, Instagram's own studies showed that the app makes body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teenage girls.
And finally, 4 amateur astronauts have blasted off into space this week and plan to spend 3 days circling the Earth. The Inspiration 4 crew, who are travelling in a SpaceX space vehicle, are marking another milestone in the race to commercialise space travel.
Another step forward for space travel. We've seen things heating up in the commercial space race, haven't we, recently, with lots of rockets launching and so on. Has it ever appealed to you, Natasha? Would you go?
I don't know. I think that there's something a bit tragic about sort of seeing people get really excited about reaching just the sort of orbit and then watching them come back down, because it feels like it doesn't take that long, realistically, to do that. I feel like this 3-day orbital experience might change my mind. I'm more of a, you know, an actual holiday to me means more than sort of a minute, if you see what I mean.
Miles or nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How about you, Matt?
Yeah, 3 days in orbit sounds like a long time to be sort of cooped up with people you probably don't know very well. But I think I'd be tempted by it, but it's just the risk as well at the moment with like that sort of space travel. Like, there's no guarantee that the rocket's not going to blow up on launch or anything like that. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'd like to go into orbit or space, but not have any risk, which sort of is impossible, really.
I'm sure they'd probably point out that you also take risks when you get on a plane or cross the street.
Yeah, the rocket's just a lot bigger, isn't it?
The rocket's just a lot bigger. Wisdom from Matt Burgess there. Facts this week. Matt, share some more wisdom with us. What did you learn this week?
Yeah, so this one, the thing that I learned this week sort of depressed me a little bit as well, because I just don't like the sound of it. So basically, I learned that this week we spend about 90% of our lives indoors, which probably isn't that surprising or anything really, but just to see it sort of written down, and this was in a story that we published around sort of indoor air pollution. But just to see that sort of fact written down was a bit like, oh, that's a hell of a lot of time that you spend indoors. And actually, the outdoors is lovely and great, and we should spend more time outdoors.
That's true, actually. I suppose if you do the maths, if you think 24 hours in a day, so 10% of that would be 2.4 hours. Obviously, you're sleeping for a large part of that where you're presumably indoors. I maybe go for 2 walks with the dog, about an hour each, maybe spend 2 hours of an average day outside. So, yeah, I can see that being the case.
Yeah, it's just a bit like, actually, maybe we should spend more time outside. But yeah, the piece that we were published this week was looking at sort of like indoor air pollution and how the pandemic has obviously taught us more about ventilation and the benefits it can have inside. And yeah, really, that I guess is something that we could probably learn to carry on after the pandemic has sort of settled down.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting idea, given that indoor pollution, regardless of COVID, is a health issue that's sort of often overlooked. Maybe it's one good thing that can come out of the changes we're making currently to deal with the pandemic. I learned an animal fact this week, of course. You'll not be surprised to hear it all, which is that ducks can talk, or at least one duck, a male musk duck named Ripper, I don't know how he got that name, can talk. So scientists analysed a recording of Ripper making sounds that sound like a closing door and the catchphrase, "You bloody fool." They concluded that these were a type of mimicry. The duck had learned to vocalise sounds that it heard in the environment. So presumably that was from its keeper, who maybe sort of said that phrase fairly often. Although they're not actually sure whether Ripper was saying, "you bloody fool," or "your bloody food." So they speculate that maybe the keeper could have said, you know, "oh, here's your bloody food." Who knows? Either way, it is impressive and tells us more about vocal learning in animals that we didn't previously know were capable for this kind of thing. Great work, Ripper. Your contribution to science is appreciated.
Some really disturbing animal things that keep on coming out. Like, did you see that thing about the tortoise that was eating the bird? Like the baby bird? It sort of feels
no,
like...
No, I did not.
It's those really disturbing sort of footage of this baby bird that was sort of trying to get away from this huge tortoise and just sort of snapping at it. And all these scientists are like, oh, this is amazing, because we didn't know that this tortoise was a predator. We thought it just only ate things that it found dead on the floor. But as it turns out, this baby bird looked very appetizing. And that was disturbing too. So bird-related disturbing animal facts seems to be a thing in the last few weeks. Can you imagine, though, like the abuse? It's like the telltale heart of birds, right? Like the birds giving away the abuse that you've given it by repeating what you've said. Like nothing is safe anymore. You can't insult your animals any longer. Not that you'd want to, but still, without them actually telling on you, because they can mimic human beings.
Yeah, so watch your
mouth. Game changer, yeah.
If you've got a pet at home, you know, who knows when your pet snail might start to mimic you.
Oh, God.
On to our first main story this week, and we're talking once again about vaccine passports. Matt, it's something we've discussed on the podcast before, but we're returning now with a specific example, and that's France. Over the last few months, the country has seen regular protests about the mandatory vaccine passports, or health pass, needed for people to enter bars, restaurants, cafes and cinemas. So what's been going on, Matt?
Yeah, so it's probably important to start this story with just a little bit of context. So France has long been one of the most vaccine sceptical nations on earth. So as recently in December, when some of the first vaccines were starting to be rolled out around the world, 60% of the French population said that they didn't want to get jabbed against COVID-19. But yet over this summer, France has become one of the most vaccinated countries in the world. So France's vaccination rate has now caught up with that of countries that had sort of led it for months, and around 63% of its population has now completed the full COVID vaccination cycle, which is just 1 point behind the United Kingdom. And between July and August, the share of French having received at least one jab hit about 73%, and overtook those people single jabbed in the US, Germany, Italy, Israel and the UK. And in the coming days, it's expected that there's the milestone of 50 million people out of a population of 67 million people in France are due to be had at least one vaccine. And as this has progressed and its vaccination program has continued, sort of new vaccinations have slowed down, as has been in the case in many countries, but they also remain sort of some of the highest for new vaccinations still happening within Europe.
So we're seeing this really big increase in people in France who are getting the COVID vaccines, at least getting the first jab and starting that process. And over the same time period that vaccination rate has shot up, France introduced its vaccine passport, also known as the health pass. And this means that you need proof of vaccination to do certain things in the country. Do we know what effect this has had? How much has this played into this really changing vaccination rate?
Yeah, so the piece that we published this week is looking a little bit at sort of the impact of the vaccine passport as well. And it does appear that it has had sort of a pretty significant difference in terms of people getting the vaccine. So the acceleration of France's vaccination campaign is largely believed to be due to the controversial health pass policy. Between late July and early August, showing proof of immunization or a negative COVID test has largely become mandatory for people entering cinemas, museums, restaurants, bars, and for those using long distance public transport. And that sort of incentive to get the vaccine, to be able to do these types of things, to take part in social, in largely social ways of life and seeing other people has been linked back to sort of the overall vaccination drive. And the move to introduce these vaccine passports was introduced by Emmanuel Macron on July the 12th. And it took a lot of people by surprise at that time. But over the week that followed his televised address where he made this announcement, 3.7 million people booked their shots on one of the French vaccination websites. And in this piece, we were speaking to immunologist Alain Fischer, who's one of the top advisors to the French vaccine campaign, and he said that the health pass did its job, and he estimates that up to 4 to 5 million people got jabbed as a result of the health pass being introduced. Of those people that were getting vaccinated after the health pass was introduced, people within the 18 to 24 bracket rose from less than 50% having at least one vaccination to over 86% in some of the most recent figures that we have. And Fisher said that he was expecting the health pass to have an impact, but maybe not as big as they actually saw. And in other good news for the government, not only did the French people respond to the health pass by getting the vaccine, now apparently 60 to 70% also appear to genuinely approve of the policy, according to some of the most latest polls.
So the health pass has obviously played a big role in boosting vaccination rates in France. It can't be the only factor, though, because this is really quite a turnaround from, as you say, a country that was sort of known for quite low take-up of vaccines, suddenly being up there with some of the countries that have the highest take-up.
Of course, yeah. I don't think you can ever really have one factor being the only sort of influencing thing here. And there's been a bit of an evidence in a shift in some people's attitudes towards the vaccines in general. So back in 2018, one survey carried out looking at sort of vaccine hesitancy in 144 different countries. France emerged as one of the most, as the most sceptical, with a third of respondents saying that they considered vaccines in general as unsafe, even though obviously evidence shows that they are not. And with this sort of like widespread distrust in mind, the French authorities originally devised a pretty cautious vaccination process, which in its first phase only targeted care homes for the elderly, as I think we've also seen elsewhere around the world. And as a result, sort of this sort of cautious approach, within the first couple of weeks of the year, there'd only been 100,000 people in France that had the vaccine, which was at the time 7 times fewer than in Germany. But sort of this campaign and this sort of like overly cautious approach, it came under a lot of sort of political pressure within the country, and then that led to the sort of speeding up of the vaccination program. As I mean, I think is also true for elsewhere around the world. There was that initial lag in terms of supply, which has then sort of like sped up as production increased everywhere. And generally sort of like experts say that sort of the overall months long mass vaccination program, which has had extensive media coverage within France, and has the data has shown has had a clear impact on hospitalizations. All of these effects have generally made the public less wary than it used to be, which has also helped people to accept the COVID passports as well. And in July, ahead of Macron's initial COVID passport announcement, the share of people who still refused to get vaccinated against COVID was down to around 15 to 20%, which was a huge drop compared to the beginning of the year. So essentially, there's a lot of different factors at play in terms of timescales, media coverage, public information campaigns, etc., that have sort of slowly convinced people within France to be less sceptical of the vaccines.
And you said earlier, Matt, that obviously now a majority of people in France seem to support the vaccine passport policy there. But vaccine passports have been a subject of a lot of heated debate in the UK and around the world. The civil liberties groups have warned that vaccine passports can exacerbate inequalities and maybe decrease trust in governments. And they've warned that mandating people to get vaccines to participate in social life risks creating two-tier societies where, you know, you have one tier of people who are able to go about and live life in one way and others who are not able to do that because they are not vaccinated. So what have we seen happen in France around this? Presumably there has been a bit of controversy.
Definitely. So there has been sort of widespread and quite regular protests taking place in France. So in early August, the number of protesters protesting every week, it was, hit its peak of 240,000 people. So we've seen big marches in the streets and protests against the vaccine passports, also other political issues as well. But these peaked in early August. And there remains sort of within some political camps and of the some sort of fears or concerns that there may be another season of sort of protracted tensions in the streets, just like we saw within late 2018 and 2019 with the Yellow Vest movement in France. And there's some of that sort of like residual anger that's still very much in place. But the crowds marching every week at the moment include a wide range of different people and different motivations. So there are hardline anti-vaxxers, there are conspiracy theorists, there are people who still support the Yellow Vest movement and have added the issue of vaccine passports to their sort of long list of grievances against the political system. There are people that are marching because of they have sort of they're on either ends of the political spectrum, but also moderates who don't want their fundamental choices about their health to be dictated to them. So one of the people that we spoke to who was protesting on this in the sort of middle sort of area of this said that they're not necessarily against vaccinations, but the obligation against getting the vaccine. And another academic study published in June this year shows that in France, sort of hesitancy towards the vaccines, including sort of COVID-19 vaccinations, is higher among those with lower incomes or lower education levels, and also among immigrants. So there's various different sort of levels of concern and different areas of people that are opposed to these. At the same time, there's also been reports emerging across France of a flourishing black market in fake health passes, which typically have cost a few hundred euros each and can be worked around the system in a few different ways, essentially. So there are multiple ways that some people are looking to avoid the obligation of the health pass as well.
And what about the businesses that had to make sure health passes were in place, you know, the bars and restaurants that suddenly were compelled to be checking these things and making sure they had that infrastructure in place to make sure that people were showing the COVID passport when they needed to? What do they make of the policy?
It was quite a surprise, I think, to many people when this was initially announced and then implemented. So the health pass has taken a toll on many of the businesses where it is required since it became mandatory on August the 9th. So cinemas lost a reported 7 million ticket sales in the month due to COVID passports, according to the National Federation of French Cinemas, and 80% of bars and cafes and 60% of restaurants saw their revenues drop by at least one-fifth between July and August, according to one employer's organisation in the area. Jean Terlon, the French president of this employer's organisation called UMIH, said the first week after the vaccine passports came into effect was catastrophic for businesses. They said that restaurants were ready, clients weren't, since the measures came quite abruptly in the middle of summer, and they're critical of the decision to impose the health pass also for outdoor tables, which are harder to control the flow of people sitting down and leaving, and also where virus transmission is less likely. However, he says that after the initial shock, the health pass is no longer creating any major problems for restaurants, and it's become part of sort of the normal business practices.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit like the adaptation we made when, you know, QR code menus came into effect and started being widespread and things like that. It's amazing how quickly things become normal and you suddenly become used to checking into venues and things like that. One of the concerns around these vaccination passes or health passes, though, is how long they'll remain in place or whether they might be expanded to act as other types of identity systems. And that's something that people have been worried about since the start of this discussion, really. What happens when COVID becomes less of a concern?
So in France, it's still a little bit unclear how this is going to play out. So there is a deadline. So it's currently stated to end in the middle of November. The health pass should stop being used, but it may also be extended if it's deemed necessary, depending on the the state of the pandemic at the time. And according to Fisher, who was one of the immunologists involved in the process, they said it's just a temporary measure that will be withdrawn as soon as the virus is fully under control. But other health experts in France also told us that they think that the measures, while they were needed, it isn't an ideal scenario. So one person said that it would be great if it was possible to persuade people to get the vaccine by showing them the figures and using sort of common sense arguments, but they said unfortunately it's not enough, adding the fact that having to resort to coercion is always a little bit of a failure in terms of public policy and information and communications efforts. So yeah, the long-term future is a little bit unsure, but officials have said that it is going to be a temporary measure.
Great. And the idea of vaccine passports is still, I think, you know, on the table in various different countries around the world. It's one potential tool that could be used as we continue through this pandemic and hopefully coming out of the other side of it. What do you make of it, Natasha? Would you be for or against getting some sort of COVID passport system in the UK? Do you think you'd accept that or would you not want to do it?
Oh, it's tricky because I don't like the idea of anyone knowing anything about me that they shouldn't need to know. I'm very reluctant, I'm very privacy driven, but I do think that one of my main issues of the vaccine passport as it was presented was that it was up to individual businesses to enforce, like who had it, who didn't have it, who was up to date, and I felt that was just fundamentally wrong. It felt very similar to some of the other measures that were put in place during the pandemic, where it was up to, you know, bartenders and restaurateurs to guarantee that people were wearing masks. It's hard, right? Because I think everyone that's been going on public transport in recent weeks has seen like the drop in the amount of people that are wearing masks, the amount of open coughing and no hand kind of covering the mouth at all. You know, it's been a bit of a shock, I suppose, after so long sort of being careful, staying at home, trying not to do anything risky. So I do think that having that extra, I suppose, that extra measure saying that if you want to go to certain places where you know it's going to be crowded, at least you know that people are double vaxxed and someone's checked, I guess that's a nice thing. But I'm very on the fence about it, I have to say, because of the whole control issue. It just feels a bit like if it were implemented, it would be up to the same people to enforce it, and it doesn't seem fair.
Matt, obviously you're a sort of privacy and security correspondent. So what's your take on it? Do you share Natasha's concerns in that respect?
Yeah, I think they're all very sort of valid concerns there. But I guess the sort of like the trickiness around this as well, particularly maybe at sort of like slightly earlier stages when some countries hadn't vaccinated as many people as they have now, was obviously this type of approach that we've seen in France in particular has acted as an incentive to get people to get vaccinated, particularly in a country that has obviously been historically very vaccine hesitant. So I think France is probably a little bit more unique in that sense. But equally, at the same time, if you've got governments leading towards coercion and sort of controlling what people can and can't do by saying you have to do something, then that's actually, for me, that is definitely a problem in terms of like people's rights and their civil liberties. And I think that when like technology obviously plays a huge part in terms of some of these vaccine passports and models and stuff as well. Like there are paper options, but quite often they're now phone-based, available to people that anybody who's got a smartphone. So there's obviously some people that don't have smartphones, but equally these types of systems are being created often by sort of private companies or organizations that have interests in bigger identity efforts and sort of selling their products around controlling people's identity or having databases around who people are and what they do, which could easily start to feed into systems or bigger systems of sort of government surveillance and control and things like that. And it is obviously, there's often examples or questions about like, is this going to be a slippery slope leading one thing to the next? And I think historically you've seen that actually these types of technologies do expand in their use case going forward. So it is very tricky, but I think that you can't ignore the sort of like privacy and sort of civil liberties implications in these types of cases as well.
definitely lots of practicalities to take into consideration. Lots of potential upsides, but also maybe potential downsides. Let us know what you think. Do you use any sort of vaccine passport wherever you are? Would you or would you not, even if it was supposed to be taking place in your country? Let us know your thoughts, podcast@wired.co.uk. We always love to hear from you and we like to read out as many of your feedback emails as we can at the end of each episode. On to our second main story of this week, and we're sticking with the theme of ongoing life under the pandemic. Natasha, you've been looking once again at some of the impacts on the workforce, and particularly this week on people who might be changing jobs. You've reported previously that people are quitting their jobs in droves at the moment, perhaps inspired by their experiences throughout the pandemic, maybe rethinking how to organise their lives. Now you've been digging into the actual experience of quitting and asking people who have left a job recently what their final days at work were like while working remotely. So what have the responses been like? What have people been telling
it's
you?
It's been traumatic, Vicky. It really has. So I asked people to tell me about their last days and what it was like. And a lot of people haven't been returning to the office. And so they spent it working from home. And I think I just sort of giving a few examples might give you a gist of the experience I've had in the last week reporting this. But if you can imagine, you're sitting at your computer, you're hoping that your colleagues are going to organise a goodbye Zoom, and then at around about 5 o'clock your computer stops working. If you see like hand waving emojis on Slack, and then your Slack stops working. If you are marking your final moments at your company by someone from FedEx knocking on your door, coming to get your laptop, and you haven't heard from anyone at all. If you have spent your time in a fetal position, curled around your dogs, thinking, I can't believe this is so depressing. I've killed myself for this company, and this is the end of it. That's basically the experience that people are having at the moment, apparently, on their last days of working remotely at their job. So you're right, Vicky. I reported a lot on the Great Resignation, which is the trend that we're seeing in these last couple of months of people basically deciding, I've waited maybe, you know, 18 months for the pandemic to be over. Now there's lots of jobs available. I'm going to change jobs. People who have said, you know, I've had a taste of freedom and remote working and flexible working, and my workplace is asking me to come back to the office, so I'm going to go. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to quit instead. And there's people that have said, you know, I fancy a change in lifestyle, and I'm going to do that now because life is a bit short, and that's what we've all learned. But these people who are actually going through the act of exiting are finding that not only are they not having leaving dues or even awkward Zoom drinks, calls, or anything at all, they're just sat there by themselves, and a lot of them are starting new jobs in exactly the same space that they had ended their last job. So there's that sort of psychological pressure of I'm in a different Zoom with different people but doing the same exact thing, sort of Twilight Zone scenarios.
Yeah, I think we've talked previously about, you know, the struggles of starting a new job during the pandemic, especially if you're working remotely. But we haven't really looked at this end of the spectrum of ending an old one. And it does sound pretty lonely from what you've said, and maybe less than ideal. Why is it that companies have this oversight? They're not really making an effort to say goodbye properly. And what's the impact of that on the people that it affects?
Well, it's weird because if you talk to people who are quitting, they have their theories. So they think that a lot of people have been quitting and that their company doesn't necessarily want to draw attention to more people leaving. People don't want to go to Zoom drinks. They don't want to organise their own leaving dues. That's another reason that people are saying, you know, it's all a bit depressing. They feel like they're calling attention to their leaving and nobody really has cared. There's sort of a slight breakdown in communication for a lot of people whose companies didn't used to be remote and are still kind of working remotely. There's been a kind of breakdown in communication where people who would normally be in the office and say, would you fancy going to the pub? It is my last day. You know, that conversation isn't happening. However, the experts that I've spoken to have said that, you know, basically companies are worryingly ignoring what they're calling the outboarding process, which is when people quit and they enter into this sort of liminal stage is what I was told when I was reporting. A sort of liminal stage, which is this grey area where you know you still have a job to do, but you've already quit that job. And in your mind, you feel like it's this sort of struggle where you're in that situation where you don't want to seem like you're imposing on anyone, but you also kind of want to be out the door, but you also want to be valued for the job that you've done. So it's sort of this tug of war that goes on internally, which makes it really hard for people to want to draw attention to themselves and say, hey, make a big deal about me leaving, because I really care about this job and I care about working with you. And even though we've been working remotely, I would still like to mark the occasion in some way so that I'm not thinking about it like some of the people I've spoken to for months afterwards. They're going, I'm still thinking about it, still slightly traumatized about what happened. I felt like it was handled really poorly. So yeah, companies are basically ignoring the fact that when someone leaves or when someone decides to quit, there are people around them that they will have worked with that will be thinking, how are these people being treated? And am I going to be treated in the same way? So experts' concern is very much that if you don't treat people well when they're leaving and you don't mark their exit in some way that is visible to other people, like you could send an email to someone that, you know, a boss could send an email to someone that's reported to them or whatever, saying thank you or whatever. But if you don't do it in a public way and you don't celebrate their achievements and their accomplishments in the time that they were working with you, it sends a really clear message to other people that you don't really care about anyone at all. And that can trigger more people leaving. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So it sounds like a lot of the formal parts of leaving are happening. You know, your equipment is taken back, you're shut out of the work systems that you should no longer have access to. But it's maybe more of the informal stuff that's, you know, getting flung to the wayside, the leaving drinks, the goodbyes and thank yous, that sort of thing. I mean, we've all been on sort of awkward leaving Zooms when someone's leaving and you've been working remotely and everyone sort of pops in to wave them off. But it is a bit awkward, isn't it? No one really knows what to do or what to say. What are our alternatives? There must surely be something better than the leaving Zoom for this remote era.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, leaving Zoom is better than no Zoom at all. that's what I've learned. But yeah, certainly that there are better ways of doing things. And I think that's where kind of everyone has to take, and this is very tragic, but it's like Natasha's PSA, like everyone's got to take personal responsibility a little bit. Like if you've been working with someone, even if they started during the pandemic and they've decided to quit, if you're working with someone and you know that they're going, it is nice to organise one-on-one conversations just to have a chat and be like, tell me a bit about where you're going, you know, make an effort, meet remotely if you can, if you're in the same location. But yeah, there are alternatives now that things are opening up to go to the pub, to do stuff that's remote, that is kind of still social distanced, to have those one-on-one Zooms that aren't group Zooms where people are just trying to kind of leave, but they don't really know how, and feel a bit awkward about everything, that there are real alternatives now. And it's a shame that it appears that no one is really taking those opportunities to kind of say goodbye and make people feel valued. Because there is this whole like dependency, right, on companies doing the right thing and them saying things like, oh yeah, I'll organize your leaving drinks if you're someone's boss, and like, oh, I'll sort it out so that you're not alone on your last day and sad, etc. But it should also be up to people's colleagues to do that kind of thing as well. And if you don't have good colleagues and you don't have good work friends, that can be a big problem.
And what about the other side of the equation, which we've mentioned briefly before? What effect can this have on people who are starting a new job remotely? Often, you know, those same people that have just left one.
Yeah, so one of the people that I interviewed for this piece gave me a really good example. He said that when he left, he packaged up his laptop and handed it to a courier to be sent back to his office. And a few days later, a laptop arrives in the post from his new employer, and he opens it and it's the same exact laptop with the same exact programs installed on it. And he opens it and it's the same, basically he's doing the same job, different laptop, only they were identical in the same exact space. And that can have a really kind of troubling psychological effect on people, especially when they haven't had closure from their last job. And that's really what this article was about, and that's what everyone was talking to me about, which is the lack of closure that people are having at work, especially when they have very little gap in between one job and the next, and if they're working at home in the same space. So whether it's your kitchen counter, your home office, your ironing board, wherever you happen to have set up shop, if you end up in a situation where you're doing the same job in the same space, that closure element does have an impact on your new job. So the big issue here is that you will feel like you have almost like hanging on feelings from your previous job. So you might think, oh, I hadn't, you know, remembered to finish this project, or I wonder how this is going. You find yourself thinking about your previous job a lot more than you would have done had you just had that clean break. And so people have been trying to do things like force themselves to go on holiday in between jobs, redecorate their home offices, and hope that that makes them feel like they're in a different environment. But what the experts I've spoken to have said is basically that the risk here is that if you carry on working remotely, that there is not going to be that engagement that you need in a new job, which means that your connections aren't going to be as good as your previous job, and therefore they won't feel as real. And you need to quickly make those connections in a new job as much as you can, because otherwise you're going to be at a disadvantage. And if you decide to leave your new job, your exit's going to be even worse than the last, et cetera, doom, gloom, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so that's basically the thing. So I think for everyone who's thinking about leaving or who is close to leaving their jobs, do set up your own leaving do. That's my main bit of advice. And even if you're just inviting a couple of people that you like to have some lunch with you, or to, you know, say goodbye on Zoom, mark it in some way, because otherwise you will probably regret it, because you'll be thinking about it for a long time afterwards. So yeah, that's
how would you do it? Is there such a thing as, you know, a good remote last day?
I don't think so. I think there's such a thing.
A less bad one.
I don't know, right? Because it's always a bit. I've been on leaving Zooms that have ended being like in a quite nice way. It's kind of ended sort of the same way as it would at the pub at 11 o'clock at night, kind of thing. But I think that's kind of rare, and I feel like it's the same effect as you know, the beginning of the pandemic, when people were like, oh, let's do a quiz. Like, the first quiz was really fun, and the second quiz was okay, and the third quiz, you were just like, why are we doing this quiz? Please make it stop. I feel like leaving Zooms are in the same category of content that works once and doesn't work as time goes on. And there is something a bit depressing, I've been told, about, you know, being alone when that Zoom goes off. So people might say goodbye to you and you might be feeling really good, and then you turn around and you're in your room alone. There's not anything nice about that. So I think, you know, if you are going to do remote working, goodbye, have something to do after work, like pack up your stuff, give it back in and go, just leave. That's what one of the people that I interviewed talked about, and he said that he felt so much better because he had this sort of negative association with his house because of the job that he was leaving, and he felt that leaving that environment was really important. So I think that that's kind of the best way to go. And, you know, I don't know, if you have left and it wasn't possible because of where you are to have any kind of in-person thing, see if you can keep in touch with people at work and do it when it is possible. That's the way to do it, right? Otherwise it's just too depressing. I don't know, there's something about a like goodbye emoji. Oh, it's so awful. Like, can you imagine years of work and that's the culmination of it? No. Unacceptable, in my opinion.
Let us know if you've got any better ideas of how to make a last day in the office work when you're working remotely. Maybe you've got some creative ideas that we haven't thought of. Perhaps you've experienced this. Have you left your job? How was your last day? Did you do anything to mark it? Or perhaps on the other side of the equation, you're an employer or a manager. What have you been thinking about to try and navigate this aspect of workplace life under remote working as the pandemic rolls on? We'd love to hear from you. Let us know your experiences at podcast@wired.co.uk. And in that vein, we've got some feedback from one of our previous episodes, Matt.
Yeah, I've got another email about Zoom dysmorphia, which Amit talked about on the podcast a few weeks ago now. So this one is from Matthew, and they say, I was struck by what Amit was saying around how the new dress down culture has led to him feeling like he can't express himself through his appearance the way he used to do in the office. And Matthew says that they've had the opposite experience, have taken the time away from the office as an opportunity to experiment with their appearance in ways they wouldn't have when they were working together in the same space. And they give examples such as bleaching their hair and also painting their nails. And they say, for me, it's been easier to take risks with my appearance when I'm only interacting with my colleagues online versus in person. And they also say that they don't think they're alone, and their experiences of going out around in central London have noticed many more men with questionable dye jobs, painted nails and piercings now compared to before times. And they say they work in a large PR agency, and while they wouldn't describe their office environment as cool in any way, they also say that they're returning to the office now and finding that they have a newfound confidence in their appearance with their colleagues. So that's a very nice email to get.
Yeah, that's great. Why not take the opportunity when things are a bit different to look at your own life and see if there's anything you want to change about various things? I think that's great. Thanks, Matthew, and all the best to you. The email again, if you want to be featured in next week's episode, is podcast@wired.co.uk. But from us for this week, that's goodbye. Bye.
Bye. Bye.